Welcome to Lives in Leadership. This podcast is dedicated to promoting thoughtful and strategic conversations about military leadership, ethics, culture, and service in the profession of arms within the Australian Defence Force. My name is Dr. Lucas Murray, and in today's episode, I'm joined by Rear Admiral Paul Houghton. Paul joined the Royal Navy in 1987 and served as commanding officer of the nuclear submarine HMS Spartan. In 2012, he became Flag Officer C Training Director and was deployed as Deputy Director of Operations in Afghanistan. In 2017, he was appointed Commander Operations, where he was responsible for all of the UK's submarine service and directed maritime operations worldwide. Beyond his military command roles, he has also held senior appointments at the Ministry of Defence and led significant transformation portfolios in the UK's nuclear defence sector. In this work, he's brought together military personnel, industry partners, civil servants, and consultants, which reflects a consistent ability that he's developed throughout his career to lead people and organisations through uncertainty, adapt to change, and deliver results at the highest levels of defence. Paul, thanks for joining us today.
It's a complete pleasure to be with you today, Lucas. Thank you.
Paul, can I just ask out of the gate, what brings you to Australia and the Defence College?
So I left the Royal Navy about 2.5 years ago. I now work for a project management company called Turner & Townsend, and I'm here seeing a bunch of clients, partners, colleagues, and friends. To keep it short, Australia is now part of the defence nuclear enterprise, something I've spent a lot of my life in and I'm still passionate about. I look after Turner & Townsend's defence nuclear enterprise offering, and I felt a responsibility to offer a conversation with the Staff Corps students whilst I was here.
Wonderful.
And happily they've accepted. Hopefully they won't regret that decision.
Wonderful. And I think that's happening after this podcast, which is great. I might just take us back. I'd love to hear if there's a formative moment or maybe early in career when you were with Defence that perhaps shaped your understanding of what good leadership looks like. This is a bit of a leadership podcast where we dive down into leadership qualities or values or practices that you think exemplify good leadership. And is there perhaps something that resonates with you in that regard?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. And I think there's so much to draw on. And I think I'll respond with sort of two examples. One's quite generic, one's very specific. So the more generic one is from very early in my career as a young sub-lieutenant and lieutenant on submarines, where I was lucky to have some really good leaders, and they helped me. It wasn't always a pleasant experience, but they helped me learn the importance of personal responsibility, and that stayed with me throughout my career. And I think that's a trait that people recognise and respect. So personal responsibility is really important. The second more specific example is when I took over the command of HMS Spartan. Now, the HMS Spartan I joined had a terrible reputation for being unreliable. She was a relatively old submarine. She had a great ship's company, but she never sailed on time, always came back broken. And the ship's company had lost faith in her ability to sort of do the things the nation needed her to do. And I joined about 3 weeks before we were due to go to sea. And we were at the tail end of a maintenance period, and there was a particular weld on the steam range which had been a problem throughout this maintenance period. And I recall the engineer coming to see me about 3 days before we were due to sail. And he said to me, he said, "Sir, I've got some bad news. The weld has failed its non-destructive examination again. We now can't sail on Wednesday." And in a moment of stubbornness, I admit it was stubbornness, I said, "That's not acceptable, Howie. I want you to come back and tell me what the base are going to do to support us getting to sea on time and delivering our program." Within an hour, the weld had its non-destructive examination concessed, i.e. it was fit to enable us to do what we needed to do. We sailed on time. We never missed another sailing, and we never came back broken for 2 years. And I realised, and it took me a little while to realise this, that I wasn't dealing with a submarine that had an equipment reliability issue. I was dealing with a cultural issue. And the cultural issue was that the ship's company had lost faith. They thought their submarine was unreliable. It was no more or less reliable than any other submarine. And they relearned their confidence in how to look after her and keep her fit for the things she needed to do. So leadership's not always about the obvious. Quite often, it's about the sort of intangibles behind.
That's wonderful, and it's really interesting to think about how perhaps future leaders could understand those sort of cultural change problems and tackle them, because they can be really complex sometimes. How did you tackle that sort of issue yourself? Like, was it sort of the questions you were asking or building up confidence in people to kind of take action? What do you think it was?
I think it's a range of things. We had a particularly important program to deliver. And as ever, the program was very tight. And if certain things didn't happen on time, then the whole program fell apart. So what I needed to do was inspire and build confidence in a team and form a team so that they wanted to be successful. And as soon as they wanted to be successful, and they were all good people, but as soon as they wanted to be successful, they'd find ways to make it happen. Mm-hmm. Now, the cost of that sometimes was I had to rein them back a little bit on occasions because they'd be a little bit too enthusiastic and that could have other problems. But as a team, we got there. And I think that's the really important point. People often look at the commanding officer of a platform as being a sort of godlike figure. And it's important there's someone in charge. That's really, really important. But at the same time, you're there enabling your team to do what they're really expert at doing. And I really enjoyed that side of it. I was never happier than when sat back in my cabin listening to them working well. That was always a wonderful feeling.
Mm. That's wonderful, being able to inspire them to have a growth mindset, it seems like what you're saying. Just because, you know, from the UK sort of context, I'd be interested to hear what you have to say about perhaps the Australian context and the future of leadership or the challenges of leadership that face Australia today. Do you have any thoughts on maybe what are some of the biggest challenges? You know, we had Dr. Florence Gaub come and speak with us recently, and she's from the NATO Defence College, and okay. talked about the sort of EU strategic geopolitical tensions, you know, with the Russian-Ukraine war. Yeah. You know, Australia's dealing with the Indo-Pacific and with China and the US. What are your thoughts about kind of leading today in that sort of context? And are there any thoughts that or parallels between the UK and Australia that you could share with some of the military members who listen to this podcast?
Yeah, goodness me. That's a fascinating topic, and I think rather than try to suggest that the UK's got all the answers here, I would actually say that the UK and Australia and many other nations are all in this together. So we've got to work through this together. Would be my first point. I think the really interesting thing for me in sort of leadership terms is that for many decades, arguably since the end of the Second World War, we've had relative stability. And so that's sort of generated a sort of culture and a system of compliance and process and long-term sort of ever more complex programs to provide military capability. And that's, you know, served us reasonably well. But if you look out to the east from someone sat in the UK towards Ukraine and Russia, what we're seeing is that capabilities don't survive very long. Drones are in the news at the moment. Generally, the capability in a drone lasts about 6 weeks. It's defeated and a new system is needed.
Right.
So that agility in procurement and supply chains, the adaptability, is hugely important. Now, you don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, though. So Australia's buying into AUKUS,
yes.
Which is huge, we'll come on to that in a minute, I'm sure, a hugely complex cultural change program, not just a procurement program. So I think the really interesting challenge for people today is you've got to hold both of those things true. You need the agility and the adaptability, and at the same time, you need the programmatic discipline and investment discipline to sustain the long-term programs, which are fundamental to strategic deterrence. We've not always had to do both of those things at the same time. So for me, that's quite a significant change.
Yeah, that's interesting. I guess the critiques talk about the submarines being, are they a good, agile, long-term solution that we should invest in Australia? You know, what are your thoughts on sort of how those sorts of relationships or those sort of deals enable us to sort of be agile?
So I think they're a foundation to agility. So, of course, with a nuclear-powered submarine program, you're dealing with defence for across all levels, really, aren't you?
Right.
From strategic geopolitical deterrence, all the way through to tactical and operational use of the submarine to deter and ultimately, of course, defeat an enemy. The agility in messaging at the strategic level is likely to be less present because you want consistency there and consistency of message. But this is my sort of point, really, about agility and adaptability. We need to develop the systems that enable us to modernise and update and refresh the capability within those submarines quite quickly.
Right.
We haven't necessarily always done that as well as we could do, because we haven't needed to. We now need to.
Yep. You've led across joint, multinational and whole of government environments. From your perspective, you know, what leadership insights might be most relevant for Australian defence leaders today, particularly in this moment of strategic change in which you just talked about?
I think it's the long-term focus.
Right.
So there's a military or a principle of war, isn't there? Selection and maintenance of the aim. It's so important. And it's so hard to do. And it's easy to get sort of slightly knocked off course because there's a particular financial issue there, or or an industrial issue over there, or a social issue over here. And where these long-term defence programmes can go wrong is if there's not a really clear-eyed view about what needs to happen to make them a success. And I'm not in Australia talking to people about how the UK's got this right. Over the last few decades, it hasn't.
Right.
And indeed, we've relearned a lot of lessons that we're now applying. And as part of my work with Turner & Townsend, one of the things I'm really keen to do is to make sure that I help other people sort of see some of those lessons and not make the same mistakes. That's really important.
And I imagine, particularly with military leadership changing every, I don't know what it's like in the UK, if it's similar. I know in the UK as well, isn't there a certain amount of time that you spend within service and then you have to sort of depart service? Is that still present?
Yeah, and how much you spend in each job depends upon what the job is and
what
rank you are.
Yeah, but does that make it hard for long-term change to occur in which people are trying to make their mark within a sort of short-term service career and then move on? Is that one of the challenges, or are there others?
It can be an unhelpful dynamic.
Yeah.
But what we try to do now is make sure that the senior leaders in those organisations are there for quite some time.
Right, yep.
Certainly 5 years and potentially longer. So you get stability of commitment and stability of vision.
Yeah.
Which is really important. So that would be my main message, that it's very boring in a way. A consistent, disciplined, programmatic approach is the route to success.
Mm.
It's not exciting,
no,
but it's really important.
And it's hard to build those practices for that. You know, people get quite excited. You talked about drones earlier. I mean, people get excited about AI and the future of technological change. And it's hard to not see a future in that.
And it has a role to play.
It does, yeah.
But there's also another saying, isn't there, which is, we far too often prepare to fight today's war.
Right. Can you unpack that a little bit?
So we're all looking at drones with interest in Ukraine at the moment. And I'm not saying they don't have a future, but possibly not quite in the form we're looking at today. Now, I don't know what the answer will be, but that's why adaptability and agility is really important. And that's that dichotomy in leadership that we were talking about a moment ago, isn't it?
Yeah.
Maintaining the consistency of long-term good programmatic discipline, but also making sure you've got the awareness and agility to change when you need to.
Right.
And change quickly.
Do you think those ideas about being adaptable, or maybe seeing different perspectives and looking at that sort of change and being prepared to deal with it, are they leadership qualities that can be learnt, or were they part of your education in military leadership? I mean, we're at the Defence College here, in which we teach military leadership, ethics, culture. What are some of the thoughts you have about training and education in this sort of space?
It's a great question, because I think we have a tendency to train people to fit a particular model. And that's not unimportant, because, you know, we want to know that people are going to behave and operate in an ethical way in conflict. That's really, really important, that we maintain our values and standards in that sense. And alongside that, though, and there's sort of almost a sort of needs must element to this. So, you know, I think as we're seeing a much more adaptable, agile, assertive opposition from different parts of the world, there's a necessity to respond to that in a similarly agile way. And I think that's a little bit harder because of our more constrained processes and systems. It's very different if you're sat in government responding as compared to a platoon commander in a trench. But the agility is still important.
Yeah, and it must look quite different.
Yes, completely.
Yeah. And, you know, and working for Turner and Townsend as you do now, and working for the UK Department of Defence, like moving from sort of a military context into a different sort of context, do you have any insights or thoughts of how other military, perhaps personnel who've developed a certain maybe ways of leading within a military organisation can sort of shift like you have, or any thoughts on what's perhaps...
Do you mean make the shift from the military to civilian industry?
Yeah.
Okay.
Are there any things that work well within, like that are sort of within a sort of leadership or ethics or cultural kind of space, translated well or not? Mistakes are also interesting.
I think there's a huge amount of translation.
Yeah.
So I was quite lucky that my last job in the military was in the submarine delivery agency, so an organisation that was that had, you know, part military people, part civil servants, and part industry.
Right.
And we worked a lot with industry. And so my context for the sort of 3 years before I left the military was an environment not dissimilar to civilian life or civilian industry. And so perhaps that helped me with the transition. You know, I think if you were leaving the military from an operational headquarters, then the difference is somewhat more stark. But nevertheless, I would also say that the sort of good leadership skills and practices that people need to employ in the military environment, in a slightly different language and a slightly different context, are also relevant in industry. Mm. So valuing people, respect for people, good business planning and discipline are really, really important in the business sector. And those are important things to us in the military as well.
And something I now notice about yourself, even in this conversation, is that you're a very good communicator, you know, of your ideas. And I think surely that's a good leadership sort of skill that works well across those sorts of environment contexts.
Well, that's very nice of you to say, thank you. I think it's something you develop as you get further into your career. I remember someone saying to a group of us when I was much more junior, he was a very senior general, he said, if you're not confident at public speaking or talking to a group, get good at it.
Mm.
I didn't quite know what he meant at first, but I've now worked out, you know, particularly as I was fortunate enough to progress through headquarters and formation command, that people listen very carefully to what you say, in ways that you don't always understand at the time.
Mm.
And so it's really important to be clear about what you're saying and what you mean. I am certain I have not got that right throughout my career, but I try to.
Yeah, and I like what you're saying there, because it also brings into what are the audience, what are they trying to gather from what you're saying, especially if it's a direction or a command?
Yeah.
You know, they want that to be very clear so that they know their role.
Yeah,
whereas in academic context, and maybe that's just the context I come from, people talk a lot about journey and process, and they're good at telling stories, but sometimes you're not sure where it's leading or what they're trying to say to you. And sometimes that's a bit coded, and that's in my field of a normal sort of way to present data or evidence or even something that you should think about as a, I'm speaking about the relationship I had with my PhD supervisor. Mm. You know, he wasn't clear on this is what you should do and how you should do it. He's telling me a story about the University of Manchester and the anthropology department. And, you know, it's sort of, what is he trying to say to me? You know, and it, there's a different way, what I'm suggesting here is that there's different ways that that sort of communication works in different contexts. And I'm sure that's somewhat a challenge for some military people going into
I think you're right, though, and what you've just described, that sort of academic approach, is it definitely has a place in the military. And so, as an example, when you're privileged to sort of lead a large headquarters staff, there are moments when you want a very academic approach, like you've just described, Lucas, and you know, that might be when you're starting to form an understanding about a situation that's going to enable you to act in the future. And you want to give people freedoms to go away and understand. Mm-hmm. So I really like what you've described there. But there comes a moment where someone needs to make a decision. And that's where you need to be really clear.
Definitely. Mm. I'd love to hear about what thoughts or advice you have to give current leaders in the ADF, particularly, as that's sort of the audience, to become better leaders in the future. We've talked a little bit about that, I guess, about communication or about adaptability. But is there any advice that you'd give to, just for your context, the audience we're pitching this podcast to is similar to the ACSC or DSCC audience. Right. So, you know, they're transitioning in some ways to becoming leaders of the organisation in the ADF.
Yeah.
For that sort of leader, like making that sort of jump, is there any, what advice would you give individuals across the services?
Yeah, there's a lot out there, isn't there?
There's a lot
of advice.
Good point.
I would boil it down to be yourself, be consistent, and trust and value the people around you. So the people around you will be doing their level best to be successful and to make the operational, whatever it is you're involved in, a success. What they need from you is consistent guidance and leadership. And you'll do that better if you yourself. Because we're all slightly different. We'll all do it slightly differently. So I wouldn't try to suggest my way of leading is the only way. Mm. It's a way.
And trusting people around you is lovely because it's also about you giving up some control of your leadership and how it might be seen and valued. Leaning on others in that sort of way can be really hard for some people who think of leadership as a way of controlling the message, the ideas. Have you wrestled with that yourself, or is there, maybe there's a difference of culture between Australia and the UK in that way, but there is an understanding of leadership here of kind of having your hands in every part, you know, being sort of aware of the team and sort of trusting others can be really hard sometimes.
Oh, I think that's a really fair point. And it is hard. You know, there's sort of two responses I'd give to your supplementary question there. The first is, the solution to the problem you've posed as the leader is to make sure that your understanding of the team and the direction you give them is really clear.
Right.
And that'll enable them. Your role as a leader, I think, is to enable your team. It's the sort of the servant leader approach, as some people describe it.
Yes.
I think that's really important. So the first thing is, as the leader, make sure you've enabled your team to be successful, and then they'll go and be successful generally. The second point I would make in response is that you need to develop an instinct as to when to get involved. Because there'll always be something.
Mm.
There'll always be something that isn't quite going right. And part of your job as the leader is to just work out what that is and make sure you intervene.
Mm. That's wonderful, because being curious about how things are going and being a bit more aware and perhaps reflexive of the team can be really hard in some, particularly in a military leadership context in which things can be moving very quickly. And you don't always have the time to just sit and think and look and see what the team is doing. You're trying to perhaps get advice quickly in meetings rather than kind of looking for those problems. There are some of those models of leadership, like you said, there's lots of advice of, I can't remember what the quote is, but it's something like, leaders don't stumble on problems, they find them, or something of that nature. And I think that can be really hard to do in a context in which I just don't have the time to, you know.
No.
Patrol.
And a quick example, I know we're running out of time, but I recall from when I was in command of HMS Spartan, there was an occasion where it was at night and we were at periscope depth, so just below the surface, relatively close inshore, and the team were doing a great job. But I remember waking up sort of in the middle of the night, and I wasn't quite sure why I'd woken up. But I realised I could just hear the sort of chatter on the comms net starting to increase. It was getting a little bit more noisy in the control room, which was near to my cabin where I was sleeping. And my instinct was, I don't know exactly what's going on, but I just want to go and have a look. And I went and had a look, and they were just getting themselves into a bit of a difficult spot. And they just needed a little bit of help to get things moving in the right direction, and everything was fine again. Now, lots of people will have lots of versions of that story.
Right,
But, as a leader, I think that's part of what you do.
Yeah, and I've heard of, we had another three-year admiral on saying doing rounds was really great for that as well, just to walk through the submarine or the ship.
Exactly. I completely agree with
that. And you can help out in those sorts of ways, in an unexpected way.
The conversation you have in the passageway is much more insightful than the formal brief you're given.
Definitely.
Because you find out something you just didn't know.
Anthropologically, that's interesting because I think both are insightful, but in different ways. And I think if you're just getting one rather than the other, it's not as balanced. And there's always a different perspective you get from happenstance finding those sorts of issues.
No, absolutely.
Well, anyway, Paul, thank you so much for joining us today and taking the time to record the podcast with us.
I've really enjoyed chatting with you. Thank you.
This episode of Lives in Leadership is copyright Commonwealth of Australia Department of Defence 2025. It is licensed under a Creative Commons by Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. Additional rights beyond this license can be arranged by contacting the.forge@defence.gov.au. For full license details, visit creativecommons.org.